From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For 15 years, Michael Feeney Callan has been studying the actor Robert Redford. Redford gave him access to his personal papers, his diaries, his letters, and they talked for hours and hours over the years. Early on, Callan says he learned that contradictions and paradoxes were what defined Robert Redford. Today in the program, Callan is joining us to talk about the book that he's written. This isn't your typical Hollywood bio. It's mostly about Redford's restless search for art and solitude. We'll talk about the life experiences that have informed Redford's views on the craft of acting, on American culture, his views on the environment and political activism. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a telling story of Robert Redford in the book about him. It is in his earliest days as an actor. He was becoming successful on the stage in New York and in television, and it seemed a successful career in film was next. But right as things are going his way, Redford isn't sure this is exactly what he wants, not for himself as an artist or for his young and growing family. So he heads out on the road, drives to Big Sur in California, and over the course of several days, he just walks and walks, contemplating his future. When he returns, he hadn't exactly figured everything out, but he does turn down a huge offer for a television program. He figured that what he wanted wasn't the money, but he wanted to set down some roots. Today in the program, we're talking about Robert Redford. This is a story that is told in the biographer Michael Feeney Callan's book. He spent 15 years writing a book that explores Redford's life, and he's joining us to talk about the book. It's called Robert Redford, The Biography. Michael Feeney Callan is a novelist, a biographer. He's written books on Anthony Hopkins, Richard Harris, Jane Mansfield, among others. He's also worked for the BBC and for PBS. Michael Feeney Callan, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here, Doug, from not-so-sunny Dublin.
Thanks for doing this. Well, I guess let me start this way. When did you first meet Robert Redford?
March 1995. First met in March 1995. And I was very clear, you've kind of already flagged it in that introduction, I was very clear that the challenge was to write about someone who was more than, you know, a pop icon. I wanted to approach it from an historical point of view and a cultural point of view. Redford had had a kind of an incrementally increasing impact on me as a kid growing up. First of all, I grew up in Dublin, and it was an era when, you know, black and white television, 60s television, well, it would have been 50s here, but we were getting it in the 60s in Dublin, Ireland being Ireland, you know, steam driven. But we were getting stuff like Have Gun, Will Travel, you know, quality written television, yeah. But also Leave It to Beaver and all that kind of stuff. And American influence was there. But the first big impact on me in terms of the power of American culture was reading Washington Irving and his coming to England in the 18th century, early 19th century, and writing the stories of English culture. So there was an interest for me as a European, looking at how Americans came and interpreted foreign culture and brought it abroad, so to speak. Mm. So it was kind of a reverse process. I was interested in assimilating American culture, and I was hugely influenced as a little boy by Jack Kennedy, who, of course, we claimed as our own as an Irishman, declaring in May 1961, America promises to go to the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And I was a little boy looking at this kind of pioneering daring.
Well, it invokes that Irish folk story about the Irish boys throwing their hats over the wall.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see that kind of thing, that sense of American ownership the Irish have, or at least investment in Americana that the Irish have, is a very powerful thing. And I remember seeing Kennedy when he visited in June 63. I never saw a man that color. You know, that was the strangest tan I'd ever seen. And the mohair suit was a blue I'd never seen. But it impacted hugely on me. As a boy, I was pen pals with Scott Carpenter's son, Scotty.
Wow.
So I was very interested in American culture. I spin that a couple of years forward, and I'd started writing biography as a dramatist to understand character better.
Huh.
So that was the main reason for biography. It was kind of like paid research work for myself.
Because this was to inform your plays, the things
yes.
that you wanted to write.
Yeah, because I'd written Ireland's very first crime television series with some great actors in it, like Academy or British Academy Award nominated or winner, actually, Ray McAnally, people like that. And we had talked about understanding character, the actors and I at that time. And I was very young, in my early 20s. I thought biography was a good way of psychoanalysis, of understanding character. So I wrote about some heroes of my childhood. Sean Connery was an easy one to do. And a friend of mine, Richard Harris, the actor who famous for Camelot. But the American thing was something that I very much wanted to write about American influence globally as a political, cultural driving force. And I didn't want to stick with movie stars. I wanted to write about Whistler. Started preparing that book, and then my editor said, well, there's a huge academic tome that's there. Why don't we look at a performing arts person? And Redford was a no-brainer because it's not just the work he was doing as a movie star, but it was the work he was doing with environmentalism and Sundance. And that's where it began. Met him in 1995, promised ourselves a five-year project, and here we are nearly 16 years later.
It strikes me that, of course, it's the details of his life and a lot of terrific details about the films that he was in and the plays that he was in and his decision to be an environmental activist and a political activist, all that, of course. But it strikes me that this is very much about Robert Redford's impressions of American culture, that it's very much about culture. And there's this story you tell in the book that I wanted to ask you about. This is in 1964, and Redford is reading an article about T.S. Eliot, who had died. And then he reads the other stuff that's in the paper at the time. Allen Ginsberg has had – there's this protest on the street. And something about all of this coming together made him write in his diary about American cultural values. Talk about that if you would, because that seems to be the kind of overriding thing is how Robert Redford sees the culture playing out and how he's going to react to it as, you know, as a performer, as an artist, as a father.
I think the interesting collision between myself and Redford as friends in making this book was that I come from an old culture where storytelling is deep and long and, you know, we can recount stories and read stories that were written, you know, hundreds of years ago. It's only 161 years since the Scarlet Letter. It's a new culture here in America. And I think Redford found, because his parentage is so strange in the sense that one part is kind of Rhode Island settler, has a Puritan background in his parentage, and one part is the kind of Chesapeake Bay frontiersman, the wild men, that his natural intelligence has a curiosity for heritage and, you know, what came before and things like that. So I was coming from a culture that is steeped in history and is naturally self-investigating. And Redford came as a Depression baby born in 1936 and growing up to intellectual awareness in the 50s when Ginsberg and the Beats and San Francisco was happening and all that kind of stuff. It was no issue for him. I mean, he was in that era in the Eisenhower 50s. The imperative was to become the organization man, to get the blue suit and go the consumer way. So Redford went the kind of Ginsberg way, even though it's interesting, Doug, what you're saying, that particular quote from his diaries at the beginning of the 60s, he was tending towards the institutional organization man thinking, and he was favoring, I think in that diary entry, he talks about the dignity of T.S. Eliot as a kind of anglicized American, and he criticizes Ginsberg for his wild man, you know, drifting on the Ganges kind of thing. But as he says, and I think I have it in the book, he later reversed that thinking because he did go the kind of rebel way. But his rebel way was towards really investigating American culture. And that's the process he's been on, especially in his producing and directing pictures. And that's this business that I think that accrues into a major American essay.
You know, one of your observations about him that surprised me some was that, you know, he was very much, as an artist, he thought a lot about and painted. I mean, he thought a lot about painting. And, of course, there's this experience that you write about him going to Paris, of course, thinking about that. And, of course, there's his craft as an actor. But you say, almost above all of that, he's a poet.
I think, yes, for sure he's a poet, because when I first met him, March 95, and asked for his cooperation on the book, he said no. And I said, being, you know, the natural Irish terrier that Irishmen are, I said, well, free speech being what it is, I'm writing a book anyway, a filmographical book about you to kind of stitch together the meaning. Because I felt there was a kind of subtextual meaning not being reported about what Redford was doing as an artist. So he said, no, I don't want to help that. And I recognized that reclusive nature in him. But we started talking about poetry, and I remember quoting, Helen, thy beauty is to me like those Nicene barks of yore that gently o'er the wayward sea, which is Edgar Allan Poe. And he said, well, you know, the first one of the first pieces I did for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts as an actor was The Raven.
Yeah.
And we both discussed the fact that Edgar Allan Poe was basically a musician, you know, the tintintabulation of the bells, 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 bells,
yeah,
all
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And a couple of days later, he rang and said, yeah, okay, let's do this. So I think there was a poetic kind of connection. But I think poetry is about the distillation of language merging with ideas. And I think film is kind of a sideways version of that. And I think Redford always saw it like that. He saw it as being that film offered the opportunity to tell a story visually, and to use words in a very distilled and potent way to deliver messages. So I think and as a human being hanging out with him late at night into the second bottle of Cabernet, it is Ted Hughes and W.H. Auden that he likes to talk about.
I wonder, talk about the conversations you would have. I mean, did you try to make them conversations, or did you try to make them interviews? Because it's interesting, you talk about that when you would talk to him, when you would do interviews with him, he would put these obstacles in your way, like get you up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go horseback riding, those kinds of things. What was it like?
Well, I tried not to do interviews with him. I learned from my experience with Richard Harris that interviews relatively are valueless. I mean, when I watched, I don't mean in this sense,
because this is
a straight intellectual engagement. But in terms of trying to interview iconographic stars, at least in my experience, what you get is you get a kind of a ritual rehearsed process. I especially found that with Richard Harris. But when I watched Bob say on the Oprah homage to Barbara Streisand, in my diaries, I call that 5% Bob, because you see him coming out and there's a series of physical mannerisms and a series of gestures and all the rest. I don't know how revelatory that kind of stuff can be. So my process after Harris and after Connery was to really try and just hang out and find out, you know, what makes the guy bump? You know, what actually does he see when he's passing a newsstand? What exactly does attract his attention? And, you know, what music he wants to listen to? And in the case of Redford, for example, you mentioned something about a search for a sense of place, this peripatetic thing constantly moving in that. And I found that with Bob, as his daughter Shauna said to me, anything of value you learn from him, you learn in movement, you know, driving on airplanes, horse riding, things like that. You have to find that. So if you asked me, even though I taped hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of conversations with him, they're not formal. They're just kind of chit chat, and that's the way it came to a book.
How do you describe your relationship to him? You think you're friends? And I mean, I guess that seems dicey if you're trying to write about a person and be honest about him.
I think, you know, Ben.
And yet you have a relationship with him.
Listen, this is the greatest question about biography. One of my heroes as biographers, Humphrey Carpenter, wrote a great book on Benjamin Britten. And he remembers standing outside the Britten house in Kensington and looking up at the window after Benjamin Britten had died. But the family had authorized the book, much as Redford had authorized me and checked, you know, me out and what I was doing out. But Humphrey remembered, God bless him, he's passed now, looking up at the window and deeply regretting what he couldn't tell, the stories he couldn't tell. There's this strange tension between friendship and adversarial relationship. I mean, I saw a quote in Salt Lake Tribune that Redford at one point said, I got fed up with Callan because he wouldn't listen to me. And I purposefully wouldn't listen to him. For example, if he told me a story, and by the way, this didn't affect our friendship. Our friendship remains as... Not this is not me talking, this is Bob talking, because I once said to him, our former friendship, and he said, no, don't say that. The friendship pertains. The work is the issue here. We're challenging each other on the work.
Huh.
But he would often tell me things that, you know, Carl Jung said, the truth is only available from the concert of many voices. And I would go to Sidney or Sidney Pollock or someone who knew him very well and say, well, what do you think about that? And they'd say, oh, that's BS. And I'd say, okay. So I'd go and in that forensic way that I think is the responsibility of a historian, you'd go for corroboration and you'd come out with the story that seems fairest. So in answer, long-winded Irish answer, but friendship, yeah, friendship, but in the responsibility of the biographer, I think there is some kind of adversarial friendship.
I wonder, it seems like the characteristic that comes up again and again in the book about Robert Redford is his solitary nature. In various ways, he describes himself as a loner. And there's even in the moments quite early in his career, you write about this moment where he's soul searching, which I want to sort of explore with you a little bit more because, you know, it seems like in some ways he could have ditched it completely. You know, it seems like there was this moment almost where and even he knew it, that he could be big. But do I want that? And there are a couple of particular stories. I'll work through that. But that seems very interesting. But this idea that even when he's going through all of this, he didn't. Now, he may have sought out people to talk with, but he says this. He says, I mostly engaged that dialogue with myself.
I don't think he sought fame. I think he was blessed with a Beatles haircut, an Olympian body, all the things that make iconic stars and very attractive to women, obviously. I don't think he sought that. I think he was driven, first of all, to survive and to raise a family at the beginning when he married a local girl here, a Provo girl, Lola Van Wagenen, and raised children. I think he followed acting as a way to get money because he was not going to be a freeloader. But I think he basically had a poetic drive. And the people, you absolutely so sharply spot this thing about him evaluating Eliot versus Ginsberg at a relatively young age. I think he was driven, as I say, to actually, you know, to write or report America. And the painting, I paint myself. Painting is such a visceral, immediate thing that I think a lot of people approach painting, a lot of artists approach the value of painting as a narrative, as an immediate, an instant impact. And Redford is fundamentally impatient. I mean, that's what makes him ornery. I think he wanted basically his relationship is to poets like, you know, Wallace Stegner and people like that. That's who he connects with. And I mean, I'm not overstating it when I say that late at night, if you can get Bob to sit down, you want to have a chat with him about the wasteland or something. That's where you'll engage him. That's not 5% Bob. That's 100% Bob. Hmm.
In the book, you quote Redford as asking himself, why did I want to persevere in this industry, in this art? And he confesses that part of it was vanity. But he says that there's more to it than that. He said that the nearest he can come to explaining the drive is something that Jack Kerouac said about the problem facing the American artist. It was trying to look at this broad sense of America, is how you put it, the variety of the experience. And Redford tells you that he wanted to study those differences. And he says this, he says, I wanted the power of witness.
I think it's huge. I mean, you probably gather looking at the book that I'm interested in heritage and history.
Yeah.
And when I came here, I hadn't been here in a while, I went straight to Arlington to pay respect to the Kennedys. That's a formative part of my character in growing up. But also the Challenger and Columbia astronauts. And one of my heroes, Gus Grissom and James Irwin, one of the men who walked on the moon, is buried there. Those graves are among these veteran graves. And you get this extraordinary sense of the depth and breadth of American history, effort, courage, commitment, moral leadership, ethics in Arlington. You get this extraordinary sense. It's an overwhelming thing. I think Redford had this sense of the encyclopedia that is America. I mean, it's an extraordinary land. I travel a lot through Europe, but... You get the sense of history and conflict and all those heritage issues in Europe. But America is so new and it's a scribble board in many ways for the direction of humanity. I think Bob, acutely perhaps more than many feels that. And why doesn't he, you know, I know he does get into, you know, the hot seat and talks to people like yourself, Doug, many times. So he doesn't engage this perhaps as much as he should in public debate and that. But I think he knows that that's a bit of a turkey shoot because he's such a glamorous icon. There's a very interesting thing about an interview he gave with Jack Kroll in Newsweek where Kroll said, why didn't he shave his head like Robert De Niro and play villains? And he asked Jack Kroll to switch off the mic. Could he go off tape with him? And he said, you know, that's bordering on unethical, Redford said to Jack. He said, you know, I believe that in what I've done as an actor, there's kind of a contract you make with the people. You become a representational and idealized figure. And I recognize, says Redford to Jack Kroll, that I am playing that role. And, you know, that's a contract I have. And that's something I feel a duty and a responsibility to. But this is one box in a series of boxes in his career. And I think as an actor, he respects and maintains the integrity of that. And he's cautious about stepping too far, I think, into the arena. He has engaged, obviously, in op-eds and debates and that. But I think the great loss, and what I hope to address to some extent with this book in levelling it, was the parallel tracks of the environmentalism and the work for independent artists to give voice to diversity are huge issues.
Let me ask you this before we head to a break. You know, you talk about the fact that there might be some, you remain friends, even though you may, there may be some disputes from his perspective on your perceptions, I guess, that you drew in the
yes.
book. But you didn't think you were ever going to get him to actually like the book, did you? I mean, didn't you know from the beginning that that this was not going to be a win situation, at least in that respect?
I think the biggest thing for me, the big moral dilemma for me, was the impact that doing this would have on my two kids, Corey and Paris, and my partner, Ree. Because, you know, any commitment, any academic commitment, any work commitment has an impact on family life. And, I mean, look at the price Redford paid in family life, or yeah. John Lennon paid. Yeah. So I knew it was going to be hard. It was a decision to make. And there were many times when I thought, I don't want to pursue this, because his nature, as you say, is reclusive. And you think, well, how much, I'm not by nature, you know, someone who likes to cause problems, but how much do you want to do this? Finally, I resolved it in my mind in thinking that the story, in terms of this Whitmanian story or Thoreauvian story of an artist who is buried in Hollywood hyperbole, was worth telling. So I persevered.
Michael Feeney Callan is with us, a novelist and biographer. His book, Robert Redford, The Biography. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Michael Feeney Callan. We're talking about his book. It's Robert Redford, The Biography. I wanted to ask you about, so he marries very young, a local girl, as you said, Lola Van Wagenen, a Mormon girl. And I don't want to spend a lot of time with this, but it is interesting. It's the first time I've actually heard Robert Redford address much about Mormonism, which you say that Lola kind of guided Robert Redford to study Mormonism. And you say he began to read, and he was kind of obsessive about reading it. He was interested in the story of Mormonism.
Yeah, I mean, to go back, to get it in perspective, you have to kind of go back a little further. When he was a child growing up, he was an only child in Santa Monica. Santa Monica Public Library was his, you know, his be-all. And he was attracted to mythology. I mean, this is very much the root as how Redford operates. This is the modus. This is the engine.
Yeah.
And that began a quest for gods, if you like. He was brought up in Christian Science. His grandmother was a Christian Scientist. That went to his mom and affected him. There was Catholicism in the family, Protestantism in the family. But when he lost his way, and it was more to do with kind of, you know, maturity and 16, 17 years of age, delinquent lifestyle, you know, stealing cars and doing that kind of stuff, and rebelling against, as I said, this kind of Eisenhower Organization man image of what Americans should be. Mormonism represented a sense of order and, more than anything, kind of family conviviality, which appealed to him. He did move pretty quickly through it, you know.
Sure.
He says 7 years, and he moved on to experiment with other religions and looked for kind of some kind of spiritual resolution. He found it in nature. I mean, he found it as Thoreau did, in some kind of commune with nature. And finally, a couple of years into the book, he sent me James Hillman's book, The Soul's Code, which is a strange post-Jungian philosopher, social philosopher, who argues for benevolent destiny. It's a really interesting argument, Doug, because he's saying that so many unhappy kids are in the world because they're in unhappy families, and they're in unhappy families because the dad or the mom is doing what they're not meant to be doing. And so they pass on a history of dysfunctionality and they create dysfunctional families. And the core in the Soul's Code is like a kind of celebration of selfishness. Do what you know you should do, what you feel instinctively is right. And Jamie, Bob's son, said to me, you know, Dad found in this, and Redford himself said to me, some purposeful kind of spiritual meaning. So he graduated from Mormonism through various experiments, religious experiments, to this kind of sense of, you know, of merging with nature. And it sounds so simple, but I'll use the great Irish expression, go with the flow. So he has a kind of spiritual resolution in this benevolent destiny. Bob is a great believer in serendipity and fate, and that transcends almost a religious sense.
I want to ask you about the time. You talk about, gosh, there's so much to get to. You mentioned his affection for Edgar Allan Poe. And there's the remarkable story when he does this, he recites The Raven in an acting class at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. But what's remarkable about him reciting that is his complete lack of inhibition, or it seemingly so. He, according to those who saw it, he flew around the room, which I have to say is kind of in contrast to his kind of contained style of acting that you get now. So talk about that, if you would.
Well, I remember – I can't remember whether – I had the good fortune to work once with Roger Moore. I directed him in something. And it was either Roger or someone close to Roger who said to me the difference between Sean Connery playing James Bond and Roger was to do with self-consciousness, that Sean had no self-consciousness. He was completely uninhibited, as you say, yeah, as you're reporting Redford doing The Raven. Where Roger had a self-consciousness, he was self-conscious that he was presenting a charismatic romantic image. And I think history reports, and Roger is very upfront about this, that he maybe is the lesser actor and Sean is a better actor. I think finally in my kind of investigations of acting, and I've talked to some really great actors who've given me some great intellectual interpretations of this, acting is finally about losing, you know, self-consciousness. And I think there is in Bob, and this is an interesting aspect of his reclusive nature, when he acts at his best, say in Jeremiah Johnson, he really does lose self-consciousness and he becomes a pretty great actor. However, here's a great query. When you're then portraying, you've made this contract that he's debating with Jack Kroll in Newsweek to become this romantic emblem for women, do you then become self-conscious like Roger? And you're presenting something that is kind of a frozen, iconic totem. So you've got this kind of tension between, if you like, two acting imperatives. And I think this is an interesting aspect of Bob as well. I think there is, in movies like Jeremiah Johnson, there's significant, powerful acting. And you get modern film historians like David Thompson lambasting Bob for becoming too kind of casual about his acting. But this may be to do with the contract Bob perceives as being a moral imperative.
Well, Alan, is it Pakula?
Yep.
Alan Pakula, of course, who directed
All the President's Men,
he noticed this.
Yeah.
In the telling of this, that something, these big parts, had somehow changed his style as an actor.
That's one, you know, Alan was great towards the end of his life, bless him, and helped me enormously. And one of these things he said was that, it's just opinions. I mean, you know, and he would say that to me. He said, you know, someone else is going to disagree. And certainly Bob will disagree. But he said, you know, I believe Bob's last great performance, I forget which movie he said it was, but it would have been a mid-70s movie. He said after that, Bob settled for a kind of compromise. But again, Doug, what I'm saying is I think this compromise is to do it with a decision, an intellectual decision. He came to say that I've become a bit like John Wayne. I've become this kind of signature character. And the signature character means something, not in American letters necessarily, but in American
life, and I owe this to people to present it. And he presented it right through till The Horse Whisperer.
You know, it's interesting that the difference his acting style as he was developing it, and I don't know if it would be too simple to say he had sort of taken on kind of the method form of acting, but it was something like that. But he learned. There's this great experience that he has doing Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh, which I have to say, just sort of as a side matter, television did remarkable things back then.
Yes.
Like you don't see anymore, like 4 hours of The Iceman Cometh on television, not to mention all the plays that were being – I mean the stuff that Redford was doing. We're not talking about, you know, banal sitcoms. I mean it was remarkable, I have to say. The book reminded me of those – I have to say.
I think it's fantastic. And when I talk about with affection about American TV affecting me in the 60s, there was a laboratory period when the technology of television applied to drama was seen as being nothing but creative. But by the time I think Kennedy commissioned a report on television in the early 60s, and the report came back to say that, I think I quoted in the book, television had become a wasteland pretty quickly. And I think that's unfortunate. But I think the way of things, the assembly line inevitability of mass media is such that, as McLuhan said, the medium becomes the message. And unfortunately, the message is a dark one.
And he learned that doing that production is when he came to know Jason Robards.
Well, this was an important relationship because he regarded Robards as an acting idol.
Well, it's interesting because you say in the book that he learned more from Robards than he did any other stage actor.
Yeah. And Robards, historically, I mean, I was interested in researching Robards, really immersed himself in O'Neill. I mean, he became the signature O'Neill actor. And that was a dark place to be and to go. And Robards himself, whom I never met, and didn't unfortunately get the chance to talk to by the time he passed. But he was certainly a non-self-conscious actor who went into really merging with character in terms of, and he was fundamentally a stage actor. And Bob still says, as I say in the book, that stage is the greatest forum for actors. Because you go on stage, as Bob says, and you face an audience in an intimate scenario and you say, let me tell you a story. And it's far more powerful as a connecting medium, an information medium, than TV or film, which has all those points removed and all those opportunities to fiddle and add with editing and glamour it up. And of course, today now we have CGI, which is the bane of so many actors' lives. And when CGI, computer graphics, came in and film changed fundamentally in the 70s with Spielberg, I mean, in many ways it sounded the death knell for actors like Bob.
Redford's observations about English or British actors are interesting, though. One particular story you tell about Alec Baldwin, he was working in a film, a Situation Hopeless but Not Serious, and he liked Alec Guinness. I don't know why I said that. I actually wrote Baldwin. Alec Guinness, the English actor, and he liked him, he said. But he found his process a little too rigid. He said that English actors tend to work out to in as opposed to in to out.
Well, you know, therein is the paradox about Bob. Well, it's not just Bob. I mean, Paul Newman said to me, who himself was method trained, that he reported a story. His wife, Joanne, said to him that it was a movie she did with Orson Welles, working with method actors was like dancing in a barrel of molasses. Bob had a respect for method acting. But the paradox was that he tried out at the Actors Studio and didn't do well, so he never kind of got there into formal method training. But he had this kind of, and I think this relates to his San Francisco period with Kerouac and Corso and loving these guys, Snyder, a great respect for this internalizing process that so many English actors use and still use. I mean, British actors are inclined to define themselves in context of their stage relationship. Even the film ones emerging today, they'll always talk first about their stage work, where Hollywood American actors traditionally define off Hollywood.
I wanted to ask about during a time when he's searching again. It's right after Lola had given birth to Shauna, And Robert Redford sends his family on ahead to go back to Los Angeles, I guess it is. And he takes a train.
Yeah.
And you tell of this kind of mystical experience that he has while the train is stopped in Gallup, New Mexico. And I wanted you to talk about that, because Redford says that he had kind of perfected this sense of meditation. And he's kind of meditating, and this sort of, he has this kind of epiphany or this kind of mystical experience. Talk about that, if you would.
You know, it's strange. Maybe it's something to do with being Irish or something. But when I was growing up, I would read about the Romantic poets and how, you know, Wordsworth or Coleridge had these amazing experiences in the Lake District in England. But the idea of the epiphany of nature elevating you in some way was never that strange to me as an Irish person growing up. So when I would talk to Bob, it was always interesting when I read all the stuff about him that there was no real reporting on why he was in Provo, why he was in Sundance, why he was in the middle of the United States of America. But when you read things like Thoreau and that, you do see the same things that Wordsworth was talking about the personal empowerment that comes with, you know, an affinity, a connection with nature. So it's not so unusual. It wasn't so unusual for me as an Irish person talking to Bob to hear him talk in this very, you know, alternative universe way about the experience of getting a sense of transcendence by separating himself from family and from New York and everything and just merging with wilderness. And this is where the sense of stewardship begins. This is where the environmental awareness and the activism and all the rest begins. But finally, he settles in Utah because basically it seems no coincidence that this is where the Golden Spike was driven that brought Eastern Railroad and Western Railroad together. This is a guy who came from two separate lines of very distinctly opposite heritage and has these transcendent experiences and says, why don't I settle here? This is my own Concord. This is my place. I'll settle here, put my pitch down, and reflect on America.
Michael Feeney-Callan is with us. He's author of the book Robert Redford, The Biography. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Michael Feeney-Callan. We're talking about his book, Robert Redford, The Biography. So it's interesting. You're talking about this. It seems like in some ways the property in Provo, what became Sundance, was part of that epiphany of his life as he's thinking about all of this. And at some point he's strategizing about his career and he begins to think about wanting to earn enough money to build a home in the mountains. And he tells the director, Sidney Pollack, who becomes a lifelong friend, that this is what he wants to do. And Pollack says, you know, what are you thinking? What are you talking about? You know, and he says, look, how is it that you can, on one hand, want to be a film actor, want to act on Broadway? He was still thinking about that, of course, yet build this house with your own hands in the mountains, in the wilderness, and be hemmed in a good part of the year because of all of the snow. How do you reconcile those two lifestyles?
Yeah, and this is what Redford wouldn't have said. Building this place in the snow is Walden Pond. It's the place that is luring me to go somewhere to reflect on why I am and what's going on and why I'm married and why I'm having kids and what's it about. And preposterous and pompous and all as it sounds, what's America about? Because he does have this peculiar literary drive. But what Sidney wanted was a film career. Sidney said that to me. I mean, he wanted a film career and he wanted the recognition. And he found it with Bob. He found it with Woody Allen and the work he did with Woody. And so his dialogue, intense and close as their relationship and friendship was, would be close enough to share that part of Bob's desire. Bob's main drive in Hollywood career was to pay the bills. And those bills eventually were used to fund Sundance and to fund the work with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and the environmentalism, some of which is incredibly important stuff, you know, predating the UN Rio conference on environmental global warming in the early 90s, all that kind of stuff. But Bob would have been saying to Sidney, Yeah, I want to go to Utah to be Bob, you know. And Sidney would have been saying, but, you know, the Bucks are here in Hollywood. And that's the way their relationship really was.
Talk a little bit about that relationship. That seems they had a falling out. And I'm trying to figure out at what point they diverged as they came. They always considered themselves friends, although they didn't entirely reconcile at the end. Of course, Pollock directs him in Out of Africa, and it wasn't entirely a great experience for Robert Redford. He thought he was over-directing, especially the sex scenes.
Yes.
Between Meryl Streep and Robert Redford.
Yeah, Redford said, Sidney can't do sex.
Yeah.
And then Sidney made Random Hearts with the same actress, Kristen Scott Thomas, that Bob had done The Horse Whisperer with. And Bob was all restrained and romantic, chocolate boxy in The Horse Whisperer. And Sidney was anything but chocolate box with Kristen and Harrison Ford in Random Hearts directly afterwards. There definitely was a feeling from Sidney that he was, or Bob, that he was being overdirected. It's summed up in a story I tell where Sidney said to me on Havana, their last film together, it was basically about a hustler, a card, or a gambler. And Sidney said, I wanted Bob to study cards, you know, with the famous, I think his name is John Scarn or whatever. I wanted him to study and get the card tricks down pat, but he wouldn't do the damned homework. And of course, when I said this to Bob, Bob hit the ceiling and said, no, damn it, I was playing cards on my own. I knew I'd do it. But I think it was, there was an example, an exact example of what was going on, that Sidney saw himself, and he'd proved himself with his Academy Awards and all the rest, as being a director of minutiae. And he wanted to do that with Bob. But Bob had become a director himself and had a different sense of himself, both as an actor, a maturing actor in his late 50s and early 60s, and as a director with an alternative, a very different style and visual style to Sidney, a very different narrative style to Sidney. So the conflict was there.
Paul Newman told you Sidney wanted to be Bob, Bob wanted to be Sidney.
Yeah. And that I think the relationship is, I'm working on a project at the moment in Europe, and I'm going back to direct a kind of celebration of 50 years of the Beatles at the Cavern. I've brought together John Lennon's original band, the Quarrymen, and I'm talking to people who knew John and Paul, and I think their relationship, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, was such an important relationship in global culture in terms of popular music and the history of music, but it was pretty identical to Sidney and Bob. It was basically a relationship. It was arm wrestling. It wasn't, you know, it was a collaboration. It was hugely productive artistically, but their motivations and the things that mattered to them were fundamentally different.
I want to ask you about Robert Redford is notoriously unpunctual.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you've encountered that. I'm wondering what you make of that. I mean, everyone talks about it. Love the man, but you know, he's often hours late to meetings and things like that. And I wonder, what do you make of it? Is it that he's bristling against some kind of conformity still, resists the regularity of time, or just that's what? What do you figure it is?
Do you know? Because the truth is, Doug, because I suffered, and especially my kids and my wife, to which I owe apologies for my application. And I very sincerely, it was a rough going thing. I've spent so much time reflecting on that. And I think that, you know, the thing about rebelliousness and all is actually the kind of easy way out answer. I don't think it's that. I think that artists are often, real poets and artists are often so, they're in such a state of distraction and meditation. It's like a Buddhist monk or something, that there's something else going on. I mean, you and I were talking before we came on about how difficult it is to interview certain people. And In the case of Redford, I think it's trying to get a good interview from Redford in a short period of time, like defined by a radio show or a TV show, is like asking someone who's juggling to sign their autograph while they're juggling. It's multitasking beyond what's possible. And I think Bob kind of pulls against this. I think he's, like, I've seen him developing storyline or developing visual ideas as he does his little drawings and things like that. And there's an airplane waiting, or there's, you know, there's a TV show host waiting, and it kills him.
How does Robert Redford contend with his looks? I mean, being extraordinarily handsome, was a mixed blessing, I think he saw. And I guess we should say that there are a couple of stories in here. One that I found so fascinating was this conversation that the director, Mike Nichols, has with him, where he confronts him. Robert Redford, which I didn't know this, wanted the role of Benjamin in The Graduate, of course, the famous role that Dustin Hoffman played. And he wants it, and he's lobbying Mike Nichols to play it. And what Mike Nichols is saying is, look at your tan. Look how incredibly gorgeous you are as a human being. It's not going to work. And he had to kind of confront him with the fact. So, but what did Robert Redford make of that?
Well, that's a great story. And it reminds me of something that's been one of the most dominant since I've been talking to writers and journalists promoting the book. I've been shocked at how stubborn media mythology is. And a famous thing in the LA Times did a whole review based on Redford's baseball scholarship at university, and it didn't exist. And the LA Times, of all people, were reporting wrongly on this thing. The Graduate story is such a stubborn one that Bob rejected The Graduate. And it's the opposite. He really wanted that role. But he had a difficulty in, and this is where the artist collides with the icon maker. Regarding vanity, I defy anyone to say they don't hesitate over the mirror when they're shaving to just see, do I look great?
Yeah,
man,
yeah.
I look great, so now I leave. So there is that element in Bob. There's no question about that. But there is also the element that he wants to be this greater artist, and that's what the wanting to play Benjamin in The Graduate, because it's such a great written role. And he wanted to do that so bad. And Mike told me, you know, I had to say, Bob, forget it. So it was a collision between Bob. I think is no more vain than anyone else. I mean, I've seen him tumble out of bed at 4 a.m. and not bother to put a comb through his hair. You know, he's a real guy, but he is aware of this other area I spoke about the iconographic deal he makes with his audience. He is aware that he's to present himself.
I guess he's by now. It's difficult for all of us to embrace the idea that we're getting old. You say that he sort of resisted that for a time, but that in the film An Unfinished Life, it seems that he finally said was willing to confront not just that for himself personally, but as an image that he would convey to the rest of the world on a film.
To me, it was a very, very important moment in his filmography, in his career. Because I was seeing a lot of them during the period coming up to that, and what I perceived was a resistance, and Richard Harris was the same, not so much Sean Connery, but Richard Harris certainly, who finally gave in a movie called The Field, and allowed he always dyed his hair and stopped dyeing his hair, and he became an old man in The Field. With Bob, An Unfinished Life is not just important because he played his age with Morgan Freeman, these two old geezers together. But I also see in that a curious return to the own self-consciousness, in the sense that the Bob I know, when my wife Ree would make meals for him or whatever, comes into your kitchen and kind of expresses affection with a kind of, that kind of character is the character in An Unfinished Life. So that's a very authentic Bob.
One thing that strikes you about about Robert Redford in the book, I have to say, is he's a great kid person. He's terrific with kids.
Terrific. Storytellers are.
Huh.
And he, you know, automatically falls into that role. And it was my happiest moments with my kids, of course, are to understand how the generational thing moves so quickly, and how, you know, what is popular and the hits of today or the not so great hits of tomorrow or whatever. But one of the great moments is watching my kids. We were anxiously waiting the arrival of this great legendary American icon, myself and Ree, my wife. And my kids were playing their computer games, you know, Grand Theft Auto or whatever. And Bob Redford comes. And the previous night we'd watched Butch Cassidy together. And the kids and their friends are sitting there. And Redford comes and says in the doorway, "Hi." And the kids go, "Hello." And return to their games. And you realize how brief the whole thing of iconography is.
Let me ask this finally, about a minute left. His relationship with his son Jamie is... he, of course, loves all of his children. That seems particularly special. And you say towards the end of the book that his son says, it's not like he's left Sundance, but he says that's where your destiny is. You need to return to Sundance. What does he mean?
I think his relationship with Jamie, as Bob says, has travelled further than most. I mean, he's had liver transplants and all, really a hard time. And Bob's life has been relatively graced, and he has avoided, he suffered a lot with the loss of his first son and to cot death and all that kind of stuff. But I think it goes back, Doug, to what I was saying about Bob having this, you know, this gravity that draws him to the center of America to reflect on what it is to be an American. And I think Jamie, having gone through his journey and is a very, is wise beyond his years, has this influence on Bob and has this vision. And all the kids are very sharp on understanding how their dad's mind operates and how his spirit works. But Jamie is the one who rings in my ears saying, you know, to his dad, it's not about Hollywood. It's not about, you know, being the romantic idol. You need to be back in the mountains doing the thorough thing. And that's where Bob needs to be.
Michael Feeney-Callan, novelist, biography, his most recent book, of course, Robert Redford, the biography. Michael Feeney-Callan, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks, Doug. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cynthia Martinez. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.